That's cultivate our motivation. Come back to having a very broad, expansive mind that includes all sentient beings, and that places all sentient beings as even more important than we ourselves are. And to cultivate the mind that is dedicated to being of service to them, to communicating well with them, to not pushing our own agenda and our own preferences, but having the ability to listen and take things in, even if it seems that we have to, at least for a while, ignore our own needs and feelings. Not ignore them, but just consider them less important. And so in this way, really work to benefit others now and to really be able to teach them the Dharma so that they can go beyond the happiness of here and now to the bliss of full awakening. So let's make that our long-term motivation. Okay, so it's been a few weeks since we were at this text. I've been to New York and London and back, and who knows where our minds have been and back, although are our minds even back? Are we here right now? Okay, so we're on the chapter where His Holiness is speaking about personal reflections on the path. So he's really talking about his own experience here and how he practices. Yeah, so in the last time he talked about how he woke up in the morning and said the verse of prostration to the Buddha, absorbed the Buddha inside, cultivated his motivation, and then recited Manjushri's mantra to wake the mind up and dispel the sleepiness, and then how he did his regular daily practice. He takes a break for breakfast. During breakfast, he listens to BBC News, not our BBC, the British BBC, And then he goes back and, continues with his daily practice. And if he doesn't have anything to do in the office, he reads texts in the morning, although he's usually pretty busy from my observation. When I was last there a year ago, he was seeing people in the morning, and then the afternoons were off. They didn't have any interviews in the afternoons. On previous occasions, he was mostly seeing people in the afternoons. And I think the morning was, his quiet time, his private time. Okay. And then he takes some time out, every year to do retreat when he can. It's difficult for him to take that time out, because there's so many people wanting his attention. Okay, so we're on page 233. Yeah, in the section that's called Gradual Progress. So here he's going to continue talking about how he practices, how he thinks about practice. Just as the Buddha was able to gradually transform his mind, we can as well. In my own life, I see progress from the time I was a child until now. Because I grew up in a Buddhist family and in a Buddhist country where everyone repeated, "I take refuge in the Buddha," I have had faith in the Buddha since I was young. Although at that time I didn't have much understanding of the Dharma, I knew the Buddha was an extraordinary human being. So I think it's very different when you come to Buddhism, when it's part of your upbringing and your family and your culture, versus when you come to it after having left your religion of origin because it didn't make sense to you, you know. So I think it's quite different. So he continues, "I came to the Potala Palace in Lhasa at age 5. Yeah, now can you imagine being a 5-year-old? I think he was only maybe 3.5 or 4 when they found him, you know, when the search party had wound up at his parents' house and he had identified the mala that belonged to his predecessor and all. And then, of course, you know, they make such a big deal. And I think it would be really hard being a recognized tulku because you have no freedom. All the adults have so many expectations of you, yeah? And they project so much on you. And then they really control your life. You know, what you can do, where you live, what you study, who your friends are. You know, because I watch, you know, the incarnation of, you know, one of my root teachers. And it's just amazing. From the time he's little, you know, he can't go outside and play like the rest of the kids. He has to stay inside. He's doing his studies and his memorization. But, you know, he can't go outside and play. Yeah, and if he walks through the bazaar, because we would take him sometimes up for a picnic in the mountains, all these people are coming like this, and he has to pat their heads and say a blessing. He can't even walk down the street and be innocuous. And then all these people come, and they bow, and then he has to give them, you know, blessing cords and things like this. And then the whole social hierarchy, you know, because who he has to go to visit and who comes to him, because not all the tulkus are the same level, okay? So, for example, he had to go to see Khyabche Ling Rinpoche, but then some of the lesser tulkus had to come and see him. So, you know, this whole social hierarchy and everybody's expectations about who you're going to be and do you remember me and, you know, and then, of course, because there's you're passing down the wealth from the previous incarnation, then there's different people that want to control the wealth in the Labrang, and you have to maybe build a new building to show that, you know, it's kind of keeping up with the Lings, you know, or keeping up with the Trichangs, and you know, and then your Labrang has to have a car because the other ones have a car, and you know, it's just amazing. So I think it's quite difficult. And especially in the case of being the Dalai Lama, where you're even more confined with more people's expectation on you. Wow. You know, it's pretty heavy duty. You know, people think, oh, gee, being a tulku must be fun. And, you know, I always get to sit in the front and everybody's nice to me and gives me money and presents and stuff. But you know, you don't have any freedom. It's quite something. Yeah. So, and also people have to realize the tulku system like this, this is part of Tibetan culture. This is not Buddhism. Yeah. Tibet is the only Buddhist tradition that does this. Yeah. And so, you know, the idea is, on one way, you recognize the children with great qualities and then you give them a good education in the hopes that they'll become very good teachers in the future. So that part makes sense. But it's also a way to pass down property because the monks don't have kids. So how do you pass down the property? It's through the incarnation. Yeah. And then, you know, not all of the people who are recognized correctly. Not all of them are bodhisattvas. Some of them are people, His Holiness says, just through, because they have some good karma then, that they get recognized. So, you know, you have to keep all this in mind. And I say this not to make people lose faith, but to just be aware, because Westerners tend to project Shangri-La on Tibetan culture, and then, you know, everything is magical and mystical and perfect, and, you know, it's, the culture has produced an extraordinary number of holy beings, but it's, there's also human beings, regular human beings there, and human beings do what human beings do. Okay, so just to be aware and of it, yeah, and not like, you know, like sometimes people are at the beginning. Okay, so Solanus says, I came to the Potala Palace at Lhasa at age 5, and my studies began when I was 7. So they brought him from Amdo, which is, I don't know, maybe 1,000 miles away or 800 miles away to Lhasa. Okay, my older brother and I studied together under the direction of our tutor. But as a young child, I liked to play. Imagine that. Okay, the tutor had a whip, so I studied out of fear. Actually, the tutor had two whips, an ordinary whip and a gold whip that was for beating a holy person. The ordinary whip was for his brother. He had the gold whip. But there was no holy pain. And they beat the kids in the monastery. You know, people go, oh, Tibetan is so peaceful, light, love, and bliss. They beat the kids in the monastery. Yeah. And, yeah. And here they beat His Holiness. I mean, even the young incarnations, they do. When I was, this is just part of their culture. You know, that's yeah. When I was a little older, I began to study the Lamrim, the stages of the path. This caused me to have a deep interest in the Buddha Dharma and increased my confidence in the three jewels as authentic refuges. When I was 15 or 16, my enthusiasm to practice the Dharma grew. Occasionally, when I received teachings or meditated, I felt very moved by the Dharma. Think about what you were doing at age 15 and 16. What was on your mind, what you thought about then. My education involved memorizing root texts and listening to my teacher's word-by-word explanation of them. So this is standard in the monasteries. Yeah, you learn some prayers. Your teachers will repeat a few words. You repeat them after, because this is even before you learn to read. So you memorize a lot of the prayers that way. And then when you learn to read, then you start memorizing the texts. And when you memorize the texts, some of them, you know, they're just like Abhisamaya Alankara, the Ornament of Clear Realizations, is just a list of terms. you know, and it means nothing to you, but you learn to memorize. And it's in verse form, and so you that's the melody. And that's how you learn, and you repeat it, and you memorize the text, which is really wonderful, because then when you need a quotation, you have it in your mind. Okay, but it's really interesting to watch them, because sometimes, you know, they're looking for a quotation and they have to start at the beginning of the chapter and, oh, okay, now I've got to do it, to find it, yeah. Okay, I was tutored by 7 debate masters from different monastic colleges. My Mongolian debate master was especially interested in emptiness. So in preparation for my Geshe exams in 1958 and 59, I had to study many texts on that topic. You know, and that's actually one of the main topics that they really debate on and study. You know, there's 5 topics in the monastic program. And the third one is the Madhyamaka. And that's where they really get into it, because there's so much to debate there. Okay, so we, meaning his Mongolian debate master and him, we planned to visit southern Tibetan on pilgrimage after my exams in March 1959. And I would study Tsongkhapa's Essence of Eloquence, that's Lekshe Ningpo, then. However, on March 10th, everything changed, and we fled Tibet and became refugees in India. Yeah, so his, you know, in 49, the communist Chinese had gone into the eastern part of Tibet. Then in the 1950, you know, come 1950, they started coming closer to Lhasa, and this continued all through the 50s. And then in 59, you know, the communist troops were in Lhasa, and they invited His Holiness to come to an opera or a play or something by himself. And of course, all of his attendants said, no, you know, they're going to kidnap you or they're going to harm you. And so what happened is in the middle of the night, His Holiness dressed up as just an ordinary Tibetan, and they fled Lhasa, yeah, and they went over the Himalayas into India as fast as they could. A lot of time they traveled at night, because during the daytime, the communist Chinese could see them and would fire at them, and so many of the Tibetans, there were about 10,000 that fled with His Holiness or soon thereafter. They had no idea where they were going. Yeah, I mean, you go across the Himalayas, you know, do you know where you're going? Do you know where you're going to wind up? Yeah, do you know what's going to be on the other side? No, you're just, you know, getting out of there. And so I remember Lama Yeshe talking about it, and, you know, when this was all happening in Lhasa, and Sarah and Drepung are both very close to Lhasa. Ganden Monastery was about an hour and a half away by vehicle. And so Lama said when all this hullabaloo broke out in Lhasa, he went in the mountains, you know. And so the Tibetans always take their wooden teacup with them. He said, we took our wooden teacups, we took some sampo, we went into the mountains. We thought it was all going to die down in a couple of days and we'd come back and resume our studies. But then they heard that His Holiness had fled, and then they knew it was really serious. And so the ones who could get away, they also fled. Yeah. Then over the time, they could leave quite easily because they were in central Tibet. The people who were in eastern Tibet, it was much more difficult because they had to come to central Tibet and then go over. Yeah. Okay. So Lama said he thought, you know, they'd just be back in a few days, everything would continue, but it wasn't like that. Okay. So when His Holiness says, when we fled, I took some texts with me. So listen to what he took with him. Shanti Devas engaging in the Bodhisattva's deeds. Tsongkhapa's great treatise on the stages of the path. His essence of eloquence, okay, Lekshing Nyingpo, and others. And he studied whenever possible. But he rode a yak, of course, across the border. And, you know, they landed, went down into India. And then Nehru was just amazing as Prime Minister of India and welcomed the Tibetans. And, you know, it was quite difficult. Most of the monks lived in the British POW camp at Baksa. Yeah, that was, if you saw the movie 7 Years in Tibet with, you know, told the story of Heinrich Ehrer, that's where he was imprisoned during World War II. So that's where the Tibetan monks landed. His Holiness, I don't know where he went. If he went to Dalhousie or Kalimpong, I'm not sure. Okay. In my late 20s in Tibet, he was 24 when he left. But why my late 20s in Tibet? No, he left Tibet when he was 24. That's your early 20s. Okay, write this down to correct. And my early 30s in Dharamsala, I studied, contemplated, and meditated on emptiness more seriously. I became more convinced of the possibility of attaining nirvana, and my confidence in the Dharma jewel, true cessations, and true path deepened. That led me to see the Sangha, those beings who have realized this Dharma directly, as magnificent and increased my admiration for them. This, in turn, helped me to develop deeper, genuine faith in the Buddha as our teacher. At that time, the thought arose in my mind that if I could actualize nirvana, I could then have a long, blissful rest. He often jokes about that, you know, kind of, yeah, you have to work so hard for enlightenment, but then, you know, then I hope I can have a long rest. No way. Whereas I have high regard for bodhicitta, and it is not difficult to understand, actually generating it seems challenging. My experience tallies with what the great masters say. Emptiness is difficult to understand. It is especially challenging to maintain the tension between appearance and emptiness, and to establish the efficacy of cause and effect in a world that is merely imputed and lacks any existence from its own side. However, when we think about emptiness and dependent arising over time, they become clearer and we gain some feeling for them and confidence in them. Bodhicitta, on the other hand, is easy to understand but difficult to experience. But there is no other choice. We have to make the effort. Okay, so emptiness, difficult to understand, but after you understand it, you know, there's a way forward. Bodhicitta, easy to understand but to experience and really, you know, get rid of that self-centered mind, very difficult. We Tibetans have the tradition of students offering their realization to the teacher, in which we share our understanding of the Dharma with our spiritual mentors. In the late 70s and early 80s, I had several opportunities to meet with my senior tutor, Ling Rinpoche, during which I spoke about my understanding of emptiness in particular. At one point, he listened very carefully and then said, soon you will become a yogi of space. which means someone who has realized emptiness. Because emptiness is, you know, is often spoken of as space. Even in my dreams, I would often discuss the Dharma with people or meditate on emptiness and bodhicitta. Are your dreams like that? In the past few years, I have had more interest and enthusiasm in understanding emptiness, and that has brought deeper conviction and experience. Once I read in a text, the person is mere designation, and a feeling like electricity shook me. I thought that perhaps this was selflessness. When I focused on the self, I could confirm that it was merely designated. But when I focused on the aggregates, the experience was not the same. That indicated that my experience was of the absence of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, not the emptiness of inherent existence. So this is, he often says this, you know, like when you have some kind of experience, and you're wondering, you know, what was it you actually saw the lack of? To first focus on the person, and, you know, if you had this feeling, oh, the person doesn't inherently exist, or in this case, the person is merely designated. Yeah. Then he says, try focusing on the aggregates. The aggregates are the basis of designation of the person. And see if you still, if you have the same feeling when you meditate on them. Yeah. Are you, you know, do you have the same feeling that they don't exist from their own side? Or do you have a different feeling? If you have the same feeling, then you've, as you had when you meditated on the person, then you've understood emptiness, or at least, you know, something similar in both. But if you have different experiences, like he's saying here, then, you know, your experience with the person was the realization of the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Okay, because you didn't have the same feeling of a lack of existing from its own side when you meditated on the aggregates. Okay, and if you remember from Precious Garland, Nagarjuna was saying that first we grasp at the inherent existence of the aggregates, and then based on that we grasp the inherent existence of the person. Today, my understanding of selflessness has improved, and that helps greatly to reduce the intensity and frequency of the afflictions, especially attachment and anger. Understanding emptiness has no adverse effect on the practice of authentic love and compassion, because these are not driven by ignorance. In fact, understanding emptiness boosts our altruism by enabling us to recognize sentient beings' suffering more clearly. Contemplation of emptiness and compassion are the backbone of my daily practice. Okay, so there, when he's talking about emptiness boosts our altruism through understanding sentient beings' suffering at a deeper level, he's really, you know, referring, when Chandrakirti speaks of the three kinds of compassion, yeah, the first one, the compassion of observing sentient beings, where you have the six analogies like a bucket, and then the compassion observing phenomena, where you see that sentient beings are impermanent or that they lack a self-sufficient, substantially existent self, and then the third one, the compassion understanding the unapprehendable, where you see sentient beings as empty of inherent existence and cultivate compassion for them that way. So those last two, recognizing that sentient beings are impermanent and that they're empty, really gives you a whole different perspective on sentient beings' situation, you know, because then you really see how people... And when I say people, it includes all sentient beings, not just humans. how people are befuddled, grasping onto permanence and not realizing that everything is changing in every moment and that they're existing in free fall. Yeah, and yet they're grasping onto things like this. You know, and then you just see, wow, look how much they suffer because of that. You know, and the same thing when you see how grasping inherent existence leads to suffering and how deeply sentient beings grasp at all these things. Then, you know, then you realize that it isn't just like a bucket in the well with the kind of gross suffering that everybody recognizes, but it's really quite an existential dukkha or unsatisfactory experience that goes quite deep, that is very hard to understand. Yeah. And then also, I think when you contemplate those last two types of compassion, the way you, as the meditator, see sentient beings also, changes. So instead of seeing them as permanent or inherently existent, you begin to realize they're neither. And then that gives you much more confidence that they can change, that they can grow, they can progress. They're not cast in iron, you know, with forever having the same limited mental state. Okay. But, you know, here, I know the question has come up sometime with us. Does realizing emptiness make generating love and compassion more difficult? His Holiness says very clearly here, no, it does not. If anything, it enriches your understanding. And the reason for that is that actual love and compassion, I'm not talking about attachment. I'm talking about love and compassion as they're defined in Buddhism, not movie kind of love, okay, and not sentimental compassion, but what the Buddha's talking about of love and compassion. Those, you know, do not depend on ignorance to exist, whereas our general attachment, our craving, our clinging to the people who are dear, our biases, our anger and resentment, belligerence, all of that is rooted in compassion. So when you realize, I'm rooted in ignorance. So when you realize emptiness, you get rid of that ignorance and then all those other branches fall down. But when you realize emptiness, it doesn't harm love and compassion at all because they aren't dependent on self-grasping. I do not expect deeper understanding or experience to come within a short period of time. Do you?
Yes.
Yeah. 10, 20, 30 or more years of practice are necessary. How about eons? But change will definitely occur when we make consistent effort. Okay? So effort, we have to make, and it has to be consistent. If it's on again, off again, then we can't build on what we've developed already. Some of you may not live another 20 or 30 years, but if you pay serious attention and make yourself familiar with emptiness and bodhicitta, you will put many positive imprints of these topics on your subtle consciousness. I have seen this in my own experience. Some Buddhist topics are easy for me to understand, but when I discuss these with some senior scholars, these topics sometimes appear difficult for them. This indicates some familiarity with these topics in my previous lives. So even if you are old now, whatever positive imprints you put on your mind stream from studying and contemplating, even for even a few months or years, will carry on to your next life and benefit you. Yeah. All the so don't, you know, say, well, yeah, I'm too old, blah, 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 you know. But just whatever you can do, put those imprints in the mind. Welcome. All the virtuous actions you do now will certainly enable you to have a human rebirth and live in a conducive environment where there is more opportunity to learn and practice the Buddhist teachings. Those who are old like me should not excuse themselves by thinking that now they're very old and nothing can be done. The result of thinking like this will be not achieving anything, so please make as much of an effort as you can while you have this precious life. What I find with Westerners who meet the Dharma when they're old is many of them are really energized instead because they say, I'm old and I don't have much time and I've got to put as much energy as I can into it. Mm-hmm. Those of you who are young have more time to study and practice, or at least you think you do. Think seriously about what is important in your life and put effort into the Dharma. Of course, whether you practice is up to you. If you have genuine interest, practice is very worthwhile. Please give this serious thought. Some followers of other religions or spiritual traditions may read this book out of curiosity. Please continue with your current practice. The Buddha never imposed his beliefs on anyone. Each individual has complete freedom to follow whatever religion he or she chooses to follow, or to follow no faith at all. But whatever you do, be a kind human being. Okay. It always kind of bothers me when His Holiness says, please continue with your old religion. Yeah? And I noticed he started saying that after 1990 when the Jewish delegation came, because there was a, you know, group of Jews came, which is a whole other story. Anyway, they were saying to His Holiness, because they had these meetings with him, our best and brightest are here in Dharamsala. You know, we want them back, you know, to study the Torah, because there's many, many Jew Boos, you know, if you look around. And so they were saying, you know, here are our kids, you know, you got them instead of us. And His Holiness was really sensitive to that, you know, and tried to explain, look, we don't try and convert anybody. Yeah. But he started saying that out loud much more after that, you know, even to the point of saying, stay with your old religion, which made me feel very uncomfortable. And when I brought it up one time, he said, you know, of course, if you feel Buddhism is better for you and more suitable for you, of course you're free to practice Buddhism. Yeah.
Venerable, I really enjoyed reading the book, The Jew and the Lotus. It was a great experience. And I remember one of the things that His Holiness, who was quite open with the Jewish delegation, told them, is that your religion, your tradition has mystical teachings that you're not making available to your own people, your own youth. And so no wonder they are out seeking for these kinds of knowledge and experiences. If you were to open those teachings to your youth and your women, the women and so forth, they may stay with you instead of searching for that elsewhere. I thought that was quite brilliant of him to say.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting too. I don't know that they would do that. It would kind of be like opening Tantra to people who were unprepared. You know, they like you know, before they talk about that, they want to make sure people are really prepared. But it is true, yeah, that I mean, the way I grew up, which was Reform Judaism, about as reform as it could get. My family was not religious at all. It was so dry. And what I noticed is some of the young Jews who were raised as Reform or even conservative becoming Orthodox because they wanted to reclaim their identity as Jews and really get into the Orthodox, into the practice. And the Orthodox were the ones who practiced on a daily basis and really centered their lives around that. Yeah, but I had no desire to become an Orthodox Jew. No way. Yeah. You know, for people that it fits, it's wonderful. It certainly didn't fit me. Yeah, I wasn't going to be. I won't even talk about it. Okay. Yeah. I mean, because your role as a woman is in the Orthodox communities, is you work and earn the money, the men study the Torah, and you have babies and raise the family and run the household. And you're like that. Yeah, very difficult. But, you know, it was interesting for me that people who were raised like me wanted to go and fit themselves into those roles because it gave them, you know, some feeling of their tradition, some identity, some way to belong to a bigger group. And I think that's what happens with some of the, I don't think it's happening so much now, but maybe 20 years ago, young evangelicals becoming more religious too, because they'd really wanted to belong in a group and a practice and so on. I don't think that's happening with the young evangelicals now, from what I hear. Okay, then His Holiness says, in Montserrat, Spain, I met a Catholic monk who spent 5 years as a hermit meditating in the mountains behind the monastery. He told me that his main practice was meditating on love. When I looked into his eyes, there was some special feeling there. I admire and respect him greatly. His life shows that if we meditate for 5 years, some result will definitely come. Similarly, if we make daily effort to train our mind, the wild monkey of our mind will be subdued. So I had the good fortune of going to Montserrat, Spain, and a few of us hiked back in the mountains, and we found this monk in his house. And of course, he had no idea we were coming. There were maybe 3 or 4 of us, and we just knocked on his door, and he let us in. And he had his altar in the middle of the room. It had a kata across it. It had a picture of Chenrezig. Yeah, and His Holiness. And, you know, and of course, Jesus on the cross and so on. And he welcomed us in. And then he said, let's sit down and meditate. So we all sat there and meditated for a while. Because his feeling was, you know, there's nothing much to talk about, but if we meditate, we really come together at the heart level and share the experience of meditating on love. So he was quite something, yeah? Quite something. They have the black Madonna there, too. There's a church that's further down and one statue of the black Madonna. Okay, now the section called Cultivating Bodhicitta. And that, I want to tell another story. Before, on that same trip, why did I go to Spain? I think because Rinpoche was teaching there. And I think that was, anyway, or maybe I was teaching in Spain. Anyway, I went there for some Buddhist reason, and then, you know, they took me to Mount Surat. And then also at that time, they took me to a home for, I don't know the politically correct word, for children with developmental disabilities. Did I say it right? So we went into the different rooms and, you know, they took us around and we saw the kids and, you know, interacted with the kids as much as we could. And many of them very severely disabled mentally. And then before we went into one other room, the woman who was taking us around said, be aware when you go in this room, there's a, I think she was a teenager, there's a teenager who is very, very ugly. And that's why she was put here, because people were afraid when they saw her face. But she is not developmentally disabled. She understands everything that people say. So be aware when you go in, don't start talking about her because she'll understand. Yeah. So we went in the room and yeah, her face was disfigured, something. But she and I connected in this beautiful way. You know, I mean, we didn't even talk. I just sat down next to her. We wound up hugging each other. But there was just some kind of heart connection there that was so beautiful. I was really grateful to her. Yeah. Yeah. And then afterwards, they took us to see the rest of the facility. But it's the only time in my life where before I went into a room, somebody said, you know, there's somebody there who's so ugly that they can't be with other people, you know, so don't, you know, don't like look and like you're shocked and horrified and afraid. Okay, now the section that's called Cultivating Bodhicitta. In 1959, Kunalama Rinpoche came to visit me. I want to see, there's a footnote if I talked about Kunalama Rinpoche in the footnotes. Yes. Kunalama Rinpoche, Tenzin Gyaltsen, okay, was born in 1894 or 95 and passed away in 1977. Was born in Kannur, India. Settled in Tibet. And in the late 1950s, went to Varanasi, where he was based for the remainder of his life. A story that illustrates the depth of his practice is in the mid-1970s, some Westerners went to meet him and asked if he needed anything. He said, "No, I have everything I need because I have bodhicitta." The next day, he sent a 1 rupee offering to each of the Westerners. Yeah. I remember Thupten Pemo was among the Westerners who went to meet him. Yeah. He was supposedly totally amazing. I unfortunately didn't get to meet him. Okay. So Kunalama Rinpoche came to visit me. So this was right after His Holiness fled. It was in 59. At that time, he told me that his practice centered on bodhicitta, especially Shantideva's engaging in the bodhisattva deeds. Around that time, I also learned about a short text Kunu Lama Rinpoche authored, The Jewel Lamp, A Praise of Bodhicitta. I think I taught that text once. Here I start? Because I think... Okay, but I didn't finish? Because I thought I had taught the whole thing. But maybe it was another time. Anyway, we should look at that text. Okay, so His Holiness requested teachings on that from Kunu Lama Rinpoche. Kunu Lama Rinpoche was a layman, by the way. He accepted and gave me the teaching in Bodh Gaya. After that, bodhicitta felt closer, and it became obvious that self-centeredness is the basis of fear and distrust. Conversely, if we genuinely care about others, even ghosts and spirits will eventually show appreciation. When our basic attitude is altruistic, then even if anger arises, it leaves quickly. It's like our mind has a strong immune system that protects it from the illness of the afflictions. Around that time, I also studied another marvelous text, Nagarjuna's Precious Garland, and a few other supplementary books. And every day I thought about and meditated on them. Because I already had strong admiration and faith in Nagarjuna from contemplating his teachings on emptiness, even reading a short passage from his writings has a profound impact on me. And so that's the way I think it's really best to read Dharma books, instead of just reading, reading, reading to get a lot of information and reading quickly and reading a lot of stuff. To read slowly, and you read a little bit and then you think about it. You read another paragraph or page more and you stop and think about it. And then you do that some more. And so you go slowly through the book, but you're really using it like a meditation because you're stopping and taking in what is being said, not just on the level of information, but on the level of applying it to your own heart. Yeah. And that makes a really big difference. You know, there's some things maybe that you have to read more quickly because you have to prepare for a course, so you're looking for the information. But when you have the chance to really read slowly, it's so beneficial. Of the 13 great classical texts, okay, there's another footnote here. And I think these are the ones in Nyingma tradition that they mostly study, yeah, in the Nyingma Kshetras. So Pratimoksha Sutra, which isn't... Pratimoksha Sutra, that's the Vinaya. Vinaya Sutra, which isn't a sutra, it's a commentary by Gunaprabha. Treasury of Knowledge by Vasubandhu. Compendium of Knowledge by his brother Asanga. Okay, Treatise on the Middle Way by Nagarjuna. The 400 by Aryadeva, we've studied that. Supplement to the Middle Way by Chandrakirti. Yeah, Engaging in the Bodhisattva Deeds by Shantideva, and Maitreya's Five Treatises, which are, okay, Ornament for Clear Realization, Ornament of the Sutras, discriminating the end, the middle and the extremes, Gyulama, okay, Uttara Tantra, And what's the last one? Oh, Yogacharya Bhumi. Okay. Yeah. Okay, I think that's right. Okay. Of the 13 great classical texts, I received the oral transmission on Maitreya's Ornament of Clear Realizations and Chandrakirti's Supplement to the Middle Way from Ling Rinpoche. The oral transmissions of the other 11 treatises I received from Kunalama Rinpoche. In addition to being a great yet humble practitioner, he was a remarkable scholar and teacher. His teachings were very precise, and he could easily cite many passages from the scriptures. When I asked him how he received his training, he told me that when he was in Kham Tibet, that's in eastern Tibet, he thought that texts were to be left behind in the sense of not clinging to the physical books, although he was definitely immersed in their meaning and it touched his heart. Okay. So, in other words, not clinging onto the physical books where you're toting around a library your whole time. So what did he do is he studied those texts in much depth so that they were in his mind. The library was inside here. He didn't have to carry a big suitcase. His translations from both Tibetan and Sanskrit were impeccable. When I received teachings on Shantideva's work, he often mentioned, here the Tibetan translation is wrong. The original Sanskrit says this, and then he'd correct it. I made these corrections in my own copy and incorporate them now when I teach that text. My teacher, Ling Rinpoche, was very kind to me. He would encourage me in my practice, telling me that if I put in effort, I could gain realizations. But if I were to see Ling Rinpoche now, I would have to confess that I still have not attained these realizations, even though many years have passed. His Holiness is so modest, it's amazing. Around 1970, my feeling for bodhicitta became more intimate. After some time, I became convinced that if I had enough time to meditate, I could become a bodhisattva within this life. However, I don't have sufficient time. That is my excuse. But for those with sufficient time, there is no excuse. But what His Holiness is doing is living bodhicitta, you know, because his day is just filled with sentient beings and reaching out and helping all of them. Yeah. I mean, if you go to have an interview with His Holiness, there's so many different kinds of people in the waiting room, okay? There's Tibetans who have just come from Tibet. There's Tibetans who live in the West. There's Tibetans. Last time we were there, they were bringing the incarnation of one of their teachers for His Holiness to teach him the alphabet. There are Indian officials. Remember, there was an Indian official with his whole family there. There are people from the four Tibetan traditions, Kagyu, Nyingma, Sakya, Gelu. They're all there. There's Westerners. There's like everybody. It's unbelievable, yeah, when you go there. Okay. I continue receiving teachings on bodhicitta and doing analytical meditation on it. Sometimes when I meditate on bodhicitta in my room, I am so deeply moved that tears come. During one period of my life, I would do lengthy meditation sessions on bodhicitta and emptiness, and almost every day I would have strong experiences and be very touched. And this is what happens when you practice consistently. Okay. At the end of his Essence of Eloquence, Tsongkhapa says that when he reflects deeply on what he has learned, his faith in the Buddha increases evermore. Sometimes his recollection of the kindness of the Nalanda masters overpowers him with appreciation for the teachings on emptiness, and other times reflecting on the suffering of sentient beings overwhelms him with compassion. He comments that it is almost as if these two feelings were competing with each other. While I do not have Tsongkhapa's realizations, at times I too am affected in the same way as he was when reflecting on emptiness and bodhicitta. Yeah. And when you really study the texts, you know, and get into them, yeah, I really think that can happen because it's, you know, I think when people like His Holiness study the text, what's happening is that they feel that, like, Chandrakirti is talking to them. You know, they're not just reading a book that was published by some guy who died a long time ago, but reading it like Chandrakirti's there and Chandrakirti's telling him exactly what he's thinking. Yeah, or Nagarjuna or Shantideva, whoever it is, they're just, you know, like giving him a personal Dharma talk. Yeah. I felt that one time in Italy when Kyabje Ling Rinpoche was there and he gave the Yamantaka empowerment. And then he proceeded in the commentary to talk about the mandala. And I felt like he was sitting there. Like I would say, okay, and there's Venerable Lamsel, and there's Laresa, and there's Sarinda, I said it right, there's Tracy, and there's this, and the walls are white, and the carpeting is some kind of brownish color, and these are the lights, they're kind of, the way he was talking about the mandala is like he was sitting right in the middle of it, and just telling you what he saw. I was just like, wow, you know, where am I? Who am I sitting in front of that, you know, can talk like that? Yeah. Now when I teach about, and another thing here, going back to what Kuno Lama Rinpoche said about, quote, leaving behind books in the sense of not always having to carry them around with you. One of my teachers from Drepung Monastery, when I lived in France, this was many years ago, he said to me one time, he said, there will be a time when your teachers are no longer here, your human teachers are no longer here. And he said, at that time, these texts are your teachers. Yeah. And yeah, like really saying, you know, here, look at them like they're living beings giving you a Dharma talk. Now, when I teach about bodhicitta, I feel very moved. There's a video on the internet of His Holiness. He's teaching on the request verse in Lama Chopa, you are my guru, you are my yidam, you know. And he says, when he's explaining it, that the you refers to bodhicitta. And so he's in the middle of teaching this and he starts crying. Yeah. I've seen that happen with him in person too. I was kind of surprised to see it was on the internet, but it's there. Sometimes when I meditate on bodhicitta in my room, I am so deeply moved that tears come. During one, I read that already, didn't I? Okay, now when I teach about bodhicitta, I feel very moved. That means my mind is more receptive and has grown closer to bodhicitta. Compared to when I was 15, my understanding of these topics has changed considerably. This confirms that the possibility of attaining awakening exists. Due to knowledge, examination, and some experience, my faith in the three jewels is firm and deep. The Buddha's marvelous teachings on infinite altruism and the wisdom of reality is indeed a living tradition. However, my experience of Tantrayana is lacking. During one period, when meditating on tantric practices such as Griha Samaja, I focused on the generation stage, which involves dissolving oneself into emptiness and re-emerging as the deity. I would try to maintain a stable continuity of this visualization and develop single-pointed concentration on it. When reflecting on the self, I would train to immediately think of myself as the deity without any thought or appearance of the ordinary I. This is the practice of cultivating divine appearance and divine identity. But in the late 1970s, I became very busy with my responsibilities to my students and the Tibetan community. Due to lack of time, I had to discontinue my long meditation sessions, and now I have fallen back to my previous level of experience. Born in 1935, I am becoming old. Maybe it is too late to practice much more. The Tibetan community in exile now has an elected government, and I want them to carry out all the governmental and administrative responsibilities. Finally, in 2011, I was able to resign my post in the government in the hope of having more time for practice. I still have many visitors and appointments. I can't refuse to meet the Tibetans who have endured so much hardship to come from Tibet to see me. I can't ignore them and say I'm in retreat when they have risked their lives to come all this way to see me. Because these Tibetans, they have such incredible devotion to His Holiness. It is unbelievable, you know. And His Holiness really is what keeps them alive and going. You know, I think I told you about when Pelden Gyatso came to talk at DFF at 6 o'clock in the morning, because it was the only time we had before his flight left. And after all the people left, I was preparing breakfast, and he was in the room, the dining, what was called the dining room. And he was just staring at, there was a picture of Chenrezig and a picture of His Holiness. And he was just staring at them, you know. And I just realized, you know, that's what kept him going. All those years that he was imprisoned in the Chinese Communist prison, you know, was his faith in His Holiness. That's what kept him going.
Yeah, also the former inmate, Navang Sangto, she was one of the nuns who sang in Trapchi prison.
I'm sorry, could you?
Navang Sangto, one of the nuns who created songs, freedom songs in prison, Chinese prison. And she had to stay, I think, about 13 years in prison and experienced a lot of abuse and such. And so she, I asked her once, how she survived all the abuse and the circumstances, and she said it was her faith in the Dalai Lama.
Yeah. Okay. So, but in the late 1970s, I became very busy with my responsibilities to my students in the Tibetan community. Okay, I read that. I love that. Okay. But I still have many visitors and appointments. And okay, I read that. Yeah, so I cannot ignore the Tibetans coming from Tibet and say, I am in retreat, when they have risked their lives to come all this way to see me. The purpose of doing retreat is to benefit others. Meeting these people brings some benefit to them, so this is part of my practice. I think the rest of my life will go like this. Although I'm sad not to have the chance to do more retreat, my greatest source of inspiration is Shantideva's verse. You know what it is? As long, you're looking at the book. As long as space endures and as long as sentient beings remain, may I too to dispel the misery of the world. Whether I attain Buddhahood or not, in this one simple existence is not important. I must at least benefit others, especially when they have problems. Bodhicitta compels me to do this. The first Dalai Lama, Gendun Drup, spent a long time in retreat. During this time, he had visions of white Tara and green Tara and wrote very moving and meaningful praises to them. After his retreat, he voluntarily began to do more work, some of it difficult and time-consuming. He gave daily teachings on different texts to his students, and he established Tashi Lumpo Monastery in Shigatse. At that time, he was already an old monk with white hair and a cane. But he was the architect and foreman who oversaw the construction of the monastery. I'm going to read that again. For all the young ones who think that it's going to be too hard. By that time, okay, this is the first Dalai Lama, who wasn't recognized as the first Dalai Lama during his life. He was already an old monk with white hair and a cane, but he was the architect and foreman who oversaw the construction of the monastery. He also sent people out to collect donations so the monastery could be built. Then, despite his age, as the manager of the monastery, he gave instruction on the daily operation of the monastery and the monks' discipline. So he did everything. Yeah? I wonder what the students did. Oh, it tells you in the next paragraph. Naturally, some of his students created trouble. On one occasion, Gendun Drup became exasperated with them and said, "If I had remained in Kangche Monastery, I would have developed some high spiritual attainments by now. But I sacrificed that to come to this place to help you, to help the larger Buddhist community and a greater number of people." Although this may have sounded boastful, he was cautioning his students to be careful, to look at the big picture, and to appreciate that their opportunity to learn the Dharma depended on others. Okay. One day, towards the end of his life, Gendun Drup said, "Now I am very old." He said it just like that. One of his main disciples then reminded him, "It was prophesied that you would go directly to a pure land. Will you do that?" Gendun Drup replied, "I have no wish to go to these higher places. My only wish is to go to troubled areas where I can serve." That is very wonderful. That truly inspires me. And that's how His Holiness has dedicated his life. He came to the Wild West. Yeah. Because when I first learned the Dharma from, you know, from Lama Yeshe and Zopa Rinpoche, I thought, you know, wow, they're in the West traveling around with all, you know, and all these hippies coming and going to Copan, and, you know, I've told you about our state of mind. And, you know, they could be teaching in Tibet and be very happy teaching to in Tibetans. Why in the world are they schlepping around, you know, Europe and America to teach these people who have no clue who they are, these people who have no appreciation for what they've done, you know, and their study and their practice, who have no appreciation or knowledge about the Dharma. And they're going around from place to place teaching these people? Yeah? And it just, it blew my mind when I thought about it. you know. It's like, why are they doing this? It's so much easier to teach your own people in your own language who grew up Buddhist instead of these Western people who are going, how do we know the Buddha exists? And, you know, how come there aren't more women Rinpoches? How come there aren't any women Rinpoches? And, you know, we don't believe in rebirth. Prove it to us. Yeah. I mean, why are they traveling around teaching us? When I thought about it, it was really amazing, you know, what they gave up to come. You know, and of course, okay, you get better food, but you don't get your own food. Yeah, there's no Sampa in the West. Yeah, and all the attempts to make Sampa here, it doesn't taste like Tibetan Sampa. No way. And you can't get yak cheese here either. Yeah. The Buddha's tradition is a living tradition. If we practice, we can transform ourselves. This occurs not through merely praying, but through meditating, principally doing analytical meditation. Principally doing analytical meditation. Okay. Buddhist practices use our human intelligence in the greatest way to develop the maximum potential of a good heart. Okay? So he's saying principally through doing analytical meditation, through using our intelligence to investigate how things exist, using our intelligence to see if our mind thinks correctly or if our mind is totally under the, you know, wave of afflictive, you know, misconceptions that prevent us from seeing anything clearly. Yeah. So he didn't say, you know, my main practice is reciting mantra. My main practice is visualizing deities. He didn't say that. He didn't say my main practice is observing the breath to calm my mind. He does all those other practices, but he's saying that the main thing that is really transforming his mind is the analytical meditation. Okay, so I think that's important to remember. Yeah, because it's very easy, you know, with the tantric sadhanas, you visualize deities and you become a deity and light's all over and you pretend that you're enlightening all beings and you say mantra and you feel good. Yeah, but you're not necessarily developing your wisdom. Not because the tantric practice is simplistic, quite the opposite, but because we don't have the understanding and the depth of feeling and, you know, and knowledge and understanding of the teachings to really know how to properly meditate doing the visualizations and mantra. Okay? Yeah, so, you know, it's really emphasizing that the purpose isn't just, you know, to feel good and to feel blissful afterwards. Ah, what a nice session. I stopped thinking about everything. You know, that isn't what he said. I'm going to read it again because I think it's important. Yeah. The Buddhist tradition is a living tradition. If we practice, we can transform ourselves. This occurs not through merely praying. Okay, Singaporeans? Yeah, this occurs not through merely chanting, not through merely praying, but through meditating. Okay, principally doing analytical meditation. Okay, so that goes not only for the Singaporeans, but for also for us. Not just chanting, you know. Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha. Or, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. I feel so good chanting Om Mani Padme Hum. Yeah. That's not what it's about. Okay, we'll do the next little section here. Or do you have questions, comments?
It's just so touching, this section. It just feels like an intimate conversation with His Holiness. Mm-hmm. And He has revealed so much here. Mm-hmm. Usually it's just, I'm a simple Buddhist monk. But He really offered a lot about how He practices and what's important to Him. Wow, thank you.
Yeah. And he didn't want to put this in the book. I pushed. Yeah, because I said it's really important, you know, your example. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, His Holiness is so humble about everything. And to my mind, I'm like, well, if He is not far, you know, He's not really getting a lot of realizations, what hope do I have, really? I mean, come on. So it kind of discourages me. It has the opposite effect, maybe, of inspiring.
Yeah.
And how could I work around that?
Yeah, Jeffrey talked about that recently, didn't he? Yeah. And how, how some people feel, what chance do I have? And so what did he do? He commented on that to His Holiness, and then His Holiness talked a little bit more about his actual meditative experience. Yeah. But the thing is, you know, we want to hear His Holiness say, yes, I realized emptiness. And it was this great feeling of freedom and space. And then we could go, oh, I have that to look forward to. Ooh, 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 ooh. And then I can say that to all my friends. Yeah, that I realized emptiness and this total freedom of spaciousness. You know, but what are the signs of a real spiritual practitioner? Is it somebody who goes around proclaiming what they've realized? No. It's somebody like His Holiness who says, I'm a simple Buddhist monk. Yeah? And who, when he's on a panel with experts, asks the experts for their ideas. He's showing us what a holy being acts like. Yeah, and it's different than our idea of somebody floating around proclaiming their realizations who scoops us up into the fantasy of all of this. Okay? So he's really, by his life, showing us what a holy being looks like and how they act in their daily life. Yeah? So remember this. This is important, you know. And it says in the teachings that you should outwardly look completely normal, inwardly practice the Bodhisattva teachings, secretly do the Tantra. And that's exactly what he does. Yeah? And so he's just showing us. Yeah. He's not like... you know, who was it? Sai Baba, you know, who like made all these things appear. And I don't know Sai Baba's level of realizations, but the way he was complete, you know, very different than His Holiness. Yeah. And so that's how I really look, you know, it's like who is humble and who is self-promoting. Yeah, and that's how, you know, you can kind of tell. So I look for, you know, I tell you the story of Geshe Ashi Thopten a lot, you know, walking around, doing the korwa with his socks falling down and his whiskers and his shemdap hiked up and, you know, nobody thinking he, you know, just thinking he's some old monk. That's it. Yeah. So he completely practiced that way too. Uh-huh. Oh, now all the hands went. So you and you and you. Okay.
Very interesting, because from hearing his story, I'm being completely inspired, because he is giving us beautiful everyday experiences that if you keep at it, when His Holiness says that he's touched by bodhicitta that brings him to tears, if I even have a moment in my practice where I feel like that, that's when I feel connected to His Holiness.
Yeah.
When I read Kensar Rinpoche's book on Insight into Emptiness and there's a paragraph that I can understand a little bit better than I did 2 years ago, that's where I connect to my teachers.
Yeah.
So I'm not seeing this as I'm hopeless. It's like I have some facsimiles of what His Holiness is describing, and maybe someday I can understand more deeply.
Yeah.
I just wondered if you would repeat that phrase, the outwardly, inwardly, and secretly.
Yeah, outwardly just appearing normal. And, you know, I think the implication is acting according to your monastic precepts. Inwardly practicing the bodhisattva vehicle. Secretly practicing the tantra.
A few questions online. Sin Laurel is asking, would His Holiness say that shamatha practice is less important than analytical? Wouldn't creating a stable, focused instrument that's capable of better analysis be just as important?
Yes, generating shamatha is very important, but if you don't have the Buddhist worldview and you aren't settled into that worldview through doing analytic meditation, then you could easily get stuck in the jhanas, in the dhyanas, yeah? Or you could even follow another path, okay? So yes, shamatha is definitely important, but you have to cultivate that in conjunction with cultivating bodhicitta and wisdom. Yeah.
And then a comment and a question from Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
The first comment is, in Singapore, the Buddhist tradition came from Taiwan and focused mainly on chanting. So maybe that is why many Chinese Singaporeans are used to chanting as a form of practice. And then the question is, how do we meditate on bodhicitta on a daily basis for a beginner?
Okay, let me go back to the first comment about chanting, you know, as your practice. Chanting can be a beautiful practice, okay? But when you do it, you have to be thinking about the meaning of the Dharma when you chant, okay? So I'm not knocking chanting, yeah, and mantra recitation. But if you're just doing it, you know, kind of, oh, mani padme, oh, mani padme, oh, mani padme, oh, mani padme, oh, mani padme hum, mani padme hum, mani padme hum, mani padme hum. Okay, I've done 108 om mani padme hum. That's good enough. But you're not attempting to study the teachings, then you're missing out. If you think that just saying the mantra alone is going to bring you Buddhahood, no. Yeah. If you say the mantra, yeah, with an understanding of bodhicitta, you know, thinking about emptiness, thinking about renunciation, then chanting the mantra has a very strong impact on your mind. Okay, so it's not just, you know, because otherwise, you know, you turn on your little thing. They have all these beautiful little things that chant mantra for you nowadays, okay? We've brought some of them back. Some of them look like little the wooden fish, small wooden fish, and look, you know. So, you know, if chanting is just saying that, then yeah, plug that in, and yeah, maybe your recorder, you know, your iPod will get enlightened, you know. I don't think so. Yeah. So it really has to do with trying to understand the Dharma teachings, okay? Prayer is good, mantra recitation is good, shamatha is good, all these things are good. But without understanding the teachings, they alone are definitely not sufficient. Yeah. And then the second question was, how to practice bodhicitta as a beginner on a daily basis.
Yes, yes.
Okay. When you first wake up in the morning, generate bodhicitta. Okay? When you go brush your teeth, generate bodhicitta. When you eat breakfast, generate bodhicitta. Whenever you do anything, generate bodhicitta again and again and again and again. And apply it, you know, if you're going to work, yeah, if you're sitting on the subway or on the bus or in a traffic jam, look around at all these sentient beings and you think, you know, I owe my life to all these living beings who have been kind to me. Yeah, my life depends on them. And, you know, in previous lives, they've been incredibly kind. You know, in this life, they're kind. In future lives, they'll be kind. I have to do something to benefit them. So you continually remind yourself of the bodhicitta meditations as you go around your day, yeah, whenever you can. Somebody comes into your office and they're grumpy, yeah, and you think, oh, I have the chance to practice fortitude. This person's giving me the chance to practice fortitude. Yeah, gee, I wish I could remember that. Sounds like good advice. I should practice that, huh? You know? So just every situation you encounter, yeah, the bodhicitta teachings are not difficult to understand. Remembering them and really putting your heart into them and believing them is much more difficult. But, you know, just we have lots of occasions during the day to remember these teachings and put them into practice. Yeah. And then, of course, formal meditation, studying the bodhicitta teachings and so on.
I love this story about the first Dalai Lama so much. I think also because it's like this is just so how monastic life is. No matter who I talk to, whether there's Geshe Lajun in Dharamsala or today the Abbess of Puyi Nanri, it's about these two things. It's about building monasteries and how to handle people in the Sangha. And that's your whole practice, it seems. And it's so ordinary and so joyful. Because I asked the abbess today, like, did you feel scared when, you know, building a big temple? She just said, no, it's what you do as a monastic. I was like, you're supposed to build big. You're supposed to grow. It's like, all right. So, you know, I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. It just, yeah, so very joyful to know it has been like that for centuries.
Yeah.
I did tell Venerable. She said so many kind, helpful things. But you know, she said
you didn't tell me.
I told you the
said.
Thing she said about the. She said in 500 years that passes like this, how often does an ordinary person have the opportunity to build a temple? She said most people will not meet that opportunity in 500 years even. So to have the opportunity. It's a tremendous blessing. Yeah. I mean, she said it like very matter-of-factly, and I was like, she's right. Yeah, and she said so many helpful things, you know.
Tell us more what she said.
Why did this come out? I was asking her about the person who, remember there was a young woman who was very interested in training and how it went, and it didn't work out.
But she was just saying how in the Sangha you have all kinds of people. You have people who are very kind and compassionate and flexible. You have people who are very easygoing. And you have people who are very picky. You have people who are always trying to avoid doing work. You have people who are so driven by bodhicitta and wanting to do everything. And she said, then those people who want to do everything look at the other people and say, why are they so lazy? And she said, that's why the Buddha had the seven ways to resolve disputes. And she said, if in the Buddha's time there were disputes, this is a degenerate age. What do you expect? It's just normal part of. And she said that if there are 18 arhats, there were also 18 weirdos. Everybody who comes into monastic life has their own personality, your individual quirks. Trying to keep everyone together is tremendously difficult. Yeah, I mean, she's talking from experience, as you do. So, you know, just hearing her talk about it, like, it's so normal. Yeah. And yes, everybody's like that. And yeah, our job is to do our best to practice together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because every time, you know, when we'd go there and I would ask her, Venerable Wu Yan, about how to handle different situations, they'd go, oh, it's like this in our place too. It's like this everywhere. It's no different. I wanted to say, you don't know the disciples here. But they just said, no, it's everywhere like this.
Yeah. And the no judgment too, you know. It really didn't work out with this person because they were sleeping all the time. But she was like, oh, what a pity. They have so much potential.
Yeah.
And they just cannot fit into this system. I wish them all the best. And that's that, yeah. But there was no like, they were bad or, you know. It was so like, yeah, let's see causes and conditions and see what happens.
Yeah, when you see people have an opportunity and they can't take it, that's really sad.
Venerable, would you please consider teaching Kunu Lama's text next year? Maybe in the deity retreat or when it's convenient?
Yeah. Thank you. Remind me next year.
I will.
I guess this is a question out of curiosity. Was Lama Yeshe older than His Holiness?
Let me think. I think they probably... I think maybe a little bit. Or no, maybe about the same age, actually. I don't know what year Lama was born in.
But he died when he was 49 in 1984.
Yeah. So figure that out. He was born in 35, yeah. Then it's the same age as His Holiness, yeah.
And also I had a question about where he says, once I read in a text, the person is merely designated and felt, and a feeling like electric shock shook me. Would that be referring to possibly inferential realization or a direct realization? Or could it be either?
No, it sounded like it was direct. It could have been inferential too, but it sounded like he was talking about a direct one. But of the self-sufficient, the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person.
But even an inferential realization could be quite powerful like that.
Yeah, it could be powerful.
Okay, thank you.
Just wanting to set a really strong aspiration that everyone in the community who has never received teachings from His Holiness directly have that soon.
Yes.
That we really try to make that possible because it makes a difference in...
Oh, yeah.
Hugely.
Totally.
Yeah,
totally.
And that we really as a community try to make that effort for people.
Yeah. And His Holiness is not teaching in the West. Yeah, and he's not teaching a lot in India either, but he's doing these kind of weekend teachings, usually September, October, November, for the groups that come from Asia. So that's kind of the best thing to go to. Yeah.
Could some of the people in the West make request for him to teach, even if we were to come to India?
He receives so many requests to come to the West.
No, but if we went there, just like,
oh,
because he's giving teachings to people in Asia that have requested and they're right. coming to him.
Right. So you have to have a big group of people because it means that you are the sponsors of it. Yeah, which means that you offer the funds to make the whole thing happen for the greater community. When I said I pushed, it wasn't like I pushed and said, excuse me, Dalai Lama, but we're going to do this, you know. It was just like, you know, he was like his usual modest self, and I said, but it's important, and then I went ahead and did it. So I think it was more like that, believe me. I didn't, you know. Yeah.